Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Alarmy, before we dive in, a few quick announcements. We're doing another live show. The last one was so much fun. You can watch us discuss live from the comfort of your own home and give us your opinions through a live chat. We're doing a special Halloween show, so mark your calendars. It's going to be Friday, October 23rd, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Tickets are pay what you want. We will be discussing who's to blame for the notorious serial killer, Ed Gein. Also, we have merch, and it's really, really cool. T-shirts embroidered with an Alarmy patch, tote bags, a very chic official Alarmy hat, and an Alarmy tin camping mug. Super cute. Go to erios.net/shop. Now, on to today's episode.
An Erios original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we'll be speaking with guest expert Ravi Rajan. He's a professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's also written multiple articles on the Bhopal gas tragedy. Let's hear what he has to say. Hi, Ravi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
So can you start off by giving us, our listeners, some background on your field of study?
Well, I worked on in the combination of environmental human rights on the one hand and on disasters studies on the other. So it's risk and disasters as pertains to the environment.
So can you help us understand India's Green Revolution? What was its goal and what is its connection to the Union Carbide Company setting up shop in Bhopal?
Yeah, good question. The Green Revolution came about in a desperate bid by the central government to increase food productivity of grains mainly, but of other agricultural commodities as well. India had was a net importer of a number of critical agricultural goods right up to the mid-60s. In fact, there was a caricature of the country as going to the world at a begging bowl for food. So the idea was that they were looking for any kind of inputs, any kinds of methods of increasing agricultural throughput, productivity, and thereby making the country self-sufficient. Right about then was a time that the Green Revolution technologies were just being invented. and being fairly significantly promoted by large, big foundations like the Ford and Rockefeller foundations, which had very large establishments, several hundred experts based in India. Lots of U.S. land grant colleges were also involved. Agricultural extension agents were trained, brought from India to be trained in these land grant facilities and sent back. So an entire support structure to augment and promote this Green Revolution system was created at that point in time. The positive end of the story, of course, is that India did become not just self-sufficient, but a net exporter of food crops. So in that regard, it was tremendously useful. The negatives, of course, are very well known, that the Green Revolution brought in very toxic and hazardous technologies, created tremendous amounts of groundwater and soil pollution, dealing with chemical pesticides in particular. And it also brought in its wake companies like Union Carbide that manufactured pesticides in India. And in the end, in the case of this particular accident, resulted in several thousand people dying and almost a million people suffering in its wake.
So what is MIC? What is it used for and how toxic is it?
Well, methyl isocyanate is the base chemical that was part of the process that involved manufacturing these pesticides that were being manufactured by the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. It's obviously a very toxic substance. We saw it graphically in the number of people who got killed instantly. It's a very widely known toxic, extremely toxic chemical agent. It was never meant to be deployed in the manner in which it was. So there were some critical design decisions made by Union Carbide Corporation, which resulted in this chemical being released on December 4th night.
What were Union Carbide's design choices and safety protocols in terms of handling the gas in the Bhopal plant?
Well, we must step back a bit because it's important to know that, for your listeners to know that this wasn't just what happened in Bhopal. There was a sister facility in West Virginia in a city called Institute, Virginia, where the plant had a long history of severe problems in the community as well. So this is a company that's had a fairly long history of problems in the United States. It had drawn historically some of the greatest fines by the EPA. And in fact, its infamy predates the establishment of the EPA. Some of the worst environmental disasters claiming lives were under the auspices of mines and other entities that are owned by Union Carbide. So there is a kind of a corporate history or corporate profile that preceded Bhopal. Now, the critical thing that happened in Bhopal is that they made a decision to store MIC in underwater tanks, whereas the original decision, the one that's there in the sister plant in Virginia, called for MIT to be manufactured and used up immediately. So in other words, by using it as soon as it was manufactured, there wasn't any of the toxic stuff left in tanks. It quickly got it converted into pesticides. And therefore, to that extent, it could never really create this kind of problem in terms of mass casualties and mass death. In Bhopal, they decided that they wanted to, in a sense, basically cut corners. They didn't want to go through the processes and facilities needed to create an in-situ production. It was much cheaper to just produce a certain amount of MIC, store it, and then use those stores to create the pesticides as and when required. So it was that kind of decision that backfired. They made other decisions as well. So the conditions of work were not very good. A number of employees left. On the night of the accident, there were three or four operators looking at hundreds of dials, thereby not really fully in a position to react or even recognize events before they went out of control. So lack of training, very low employee morale because of these kinds of decisions that are made, cost-cutting decisions that have been made. as well as the underground storage, meant that they neither had a way of preventing this runaway accident, nor the people and the personnel to actually deal with it. And the other problem, of course, was in some respects, the company had done what a lot of companies do in these company towns, which is that they had the system, the government, the key people, pretty much, you know, either under their payroll or in a system of favoritism, which meant that there was a degree of laxity in regulating the plant, which could otherwise also have mitigated some of the worst impact. So between cost cutting and decisions that are, you know, simply put profit over safety, between very poor safety cultures and protocols to begin with, a low employee morale, and a very poor regulatory environment, you had a recipe for disaster that took place.
Can you walk us through what happened that night?
Well, what happened was that people woke up around the middle of the night, early hours of the morning of December 3rd, 1984, with a feeling of what they described as burning sensations. Some people refer to it as there's literally the sensation of burning chili pepper in their throats. And very soon, they were coughing, they were unable to breathe, it became very difficult. There was really no real proper warning system, no rehearsals had ever taken place. Nothing had prepared people for what could happen. With the result that they basically ran up and started running from their homes. In that process, they ended up inhaling more. And we don't really know how many. That's still a highly contested figure. But one could say safely that between 2,000 and 6,000 bodies were found based on the number of shrouds that had been requisitioned the following days, etc. Animals were also died, so tens of thousands of, regular animals, cats, dogs, goats, cows, and the whole thing was like a war zone of dead bodies the following morning. And of course, subsequently what happened was that amongst those who survived, they obviously came in with extremely poor capacities to work and make a living. So they lived pretty much a life of fair degree of economic destitution through the rest of their lives, it continues today. And some of them had progeny, or their children, or smaller people had progeny, and they too have suffered from all manner of illnesses and cancers and so on. So in that regard, the horror is still continuing for many of these people into the tens of thousands. Some estimates put the numbers at close to a million people who are still suffering.
I was wondering if you could actually specify for those thousands who did survive but suffered long-term effects from the exposure, how were they later affected?
All manner of things. I mean, so it depends on where you are, I mean, in the spectrum of things. But obviously there's a significant degree of cognitive impairment. There's a wide range of cancers that have taken place. Women have particularly faced the brunt of it, in terms of a wide range of reproductive illnesses and so on. There've been genetic mutations in progeny. So yeah, it covers the entire gamut. It's the worst kind of dystopia that one could imagine that actually happened. And it's continuing to, unfortunately, unfold.
Going back a little bit, I'm from Miami, and I grew up being taught about hurricane preparedness. And our producer Amanda, she's from California. She grew up with earthquake drills in school. But in the case of Bhopal, it doesn't seem like the local residents were told what to do in case of a gas leak. In fact, I don't think they even knew that there was that kind of threat. Why is that? And could have saved lives.
Absolutely, they you're absolutely right. They had no clue. And that is because the company kept saying that there's nothing dangerous here. There were advertisements that I've fished out during my research and even published, which talk about them as harbingers of growth and economic prosperity and well-being for all. They completely played down the toxic potential of some of their facilities or how dangerous they were. Maybe that's because they perceived that it would draw adverse attention, whatever the reasons are, far from rehearsals and preparedness, they actually actively promoted the idea that they're nothing but sources of employment and growth. So there was nothing at all anywhere. Far from it. I mean, right down to the event itself, where there wasn't even a clear communication about what to do. So it's one thing to say, well, I mean, you know, prepare people to evacuate, or, you know, put a cold water compress on their faces or something and stay put. It's another to not even be told what to do. There was no broadcast. There was no loudspeaker. They told them what to do. Absolutely nothing.
I mean, I read that the hospitals didn't know, the doctors didn't even know what was happening when people started showing up.
Nobody knew what was happening. Nobody knew what was happening. And there were controversies galore about what actually happened. In fact, after the disaster, Union Carbide, put out a significant amount of resources in disclaiming that there was anything toxic involved. They said that there's no possibility that this could be cyanide or anything at all related to it. They claimed that this couldn't happen in a modern plant like this. Subsequently, they said, well, you know, it's really not our processes. It's a disgruntled employee and sabotage. And that, again, was a crazy theory because they never really brought up that sabotage theory in a courtroom. So obviously, it was just, you know, for the consumption of the media. So it was a whole-scale denial of what actually did, what they did, and denial of responsibility.
So after discovering the leak in the MIC tank, I read that there was a maintenance personnel who took a tea break. Did this happen? How is this possible?
No, they were actually flushing. This is, you know, remember I told you that they'd stored MIC in underground tanks, I beg your pardon. And so what was going on was that they were actually flushing the pipes with water. And unbeknownst to the operators, one of the valves that was meant to keep the water from getting into the MIC tanks and actually was not working. It had malfunctioned. So this water, which had been used during a routine maintenance operation, trickled down into the tank. And that's what caused the explosion. That's what caused the reaction. Then this gas kind of came out and went through the valve into the upper atmosphere. So it wasn't so much that anybody was having a break. There just weren't enough people to monitor anything. So they were maintaining the plant. Most of a critical amount of employees had voluntarily left the plant because the conditions of work were not very good. Some employees were reassigned to monitor these complicated machinery, and they wanted training and they weren't given it. So some of them left, with the result that you had a few people looking at the whole thing, and nobody knew what was going on or what needed to be done.
Is there a correlation between the economic class living nearby and the company's lack of safety protocols?
Not necessarily. I mean, the point is, there's been a lot made about the classic EJ interpretation, environmental justice interpretation of Bhopal. The reality is that the shanty towns are populated mainly by their own workers who had moved in because of the plant and the economic activity that the plant generated. So it was not the case of a plant being located in a shantytown area. It was a case of a shantytown that grew around in a kind of a very kind of colloquial, unplanned way around the plant. But that necessarily wasn't the problem alone. There was a degree of environmental luck, if you will. I don't know if such a term exists, but to some extent it was involved in that it was winter. And there was what's called the inversion effect, wherein the inner atmosphere was pretty much low down. So the gas couldn't escape. So the reason why the gas pretty much sat there and killed all these people in the poorest areas was because the gas couldn't escape. So had this thing happened, for example, a few months earlier in the middle of the summer, the gas would have escaped. And in fact, there'd been lesser deaths around the plant, but nor in a much wider diffused area around the plant, maybe with different effects. Maybe people wouldn't have died in these large numbers. We don't really know. But that's the problem. It is the fact that things simply sat there because of the winter.
Oh, It feels like a perfect storm. After the accident, who served time for this? And were there people who got away unscathed that you feel should have shouldered some of the blame?
Well, nobody did. I mean, there was an attempt, you know, it is a very clever, and I've documented this in my own writing when I researched this. To begin with, you know, the public relations thing kicked in big time, as well as lobbying work. The U.S. government lobbied heavily with the Indian government to not assign blame. A U.S. court ruled that India was the place to try it. And some people cynically, and I don't know how much of this is true, some cynics argue that the reason the U.S. court did it, made such a ruling, was that they felt that the Indian courts were not equipped because of the absence of such cases to deal with it. Whereas had it been tried in a U.S. court, it would have resulted in at least a big, large civil state settlement, which didn't transpire. Remember that the company made a profit on the year in which it settled the lawsuit out of court. So, in fact, the largest profit ever in its 70-plus year history. So the company actually bounced back tremendously, and it's a kind of an example of how well a company, any corporation in a similar plight, can recover post a disaster like this. So it is an example of great disaster management on behalf of the corporations. Now, as far as liability is concerned, there was a court case that took place a year later, which the Supreme Court of India took up to create some kind of a precedence, in which they argued, they actually ruled, that the top management of a corporation should be held criminally liable for compensation. So they created a doctrine of criminal liability. But that besides, when the CEO of the U.S. company came to India, he was very quickly whisked away on grounds and fears that he might be arrested in India. And subsequently, he lived the rest of his life in relative luxury and somewhere in upstate New York, if I remember correctly. So he escaped. Then the other end of the drama was the parent company, the Union Carbide Corporation, claimed that they're not liable at all because the company that is incorporated in India, Union Carbide India Limited, UCIL, was the one that is actually operationally responsible for the plant. So they passed the buck to the Indian subsidiary, even though some of the design decisions were made here in Virginia. So there's a tremendous amount of very interesting and clever lawyering that got involved, which meant that basically no one, you know, faced any time, or there wasn't even a significant compensation payment.
This company, what was the Indian side of the company that was involved? How involved were they, and were they mismanaging?
Well, it is a subsidiary. It is called Union Carbide India Limited. So it still was Union Carbide. It is just that when a company goes to another country, it incorporates there as a separate entity. Union Carbide still had, a majority ownership, or maybe a small minority. I need to go back and look at my numbers. But at least a significant percentage of the ownership was, you know, held by the parent company, Union Carbide Corporation. And on top of that, of course, they did, you know, it is their technology, it is their kind of overall oversight and management, you know, which didn't really matter very much when it came to regular profits and so on. It did come to roost when the accident occurred, because at that point they could simply say, look, you know, we're not responsible to those guys.
What do you think? Have we as a society learned from this, you know, terrible tragedy, or is this kind of disaster still a threat?
No, the simple answer is absolutely not. It is going to happen again. You know, unlike, you know, I often tell my students, and, you know, especially that there's an analogy here with, you know, with civil aviation and maybe the regulation of pharmaceuticals, where we do make an attempt at trying to learn, although, you know, with the latest Boeing fiascos, I don't even know that much about, you know, I can't say with certainty about civil aviation either now. But certainly, the global regulatory environment, if anything, has worsened and weakened in the last 30 years. And it's not just, at least, you know, during the time of Bhopal, one could say with a reasonable confidence that in a country like the U.S., this wouldn't happen. It only would happen in a relatively emerging economy with lesser with a laxer regulatory environment. I'm not even sure we can say that now, because we've had such an erosion of regulation, both in terms of the legal system, as well as the capacity to enforce and the money to enforce it, that I think, if anything, we've actually regressed into the past. And I don't think necessarily that this scale of disaster is restricted to an emerging developing country. It could happen anywhere, I would imagine. And the worst fears are, of course, in the nuclear domain, which I really live in fear of every day. Literally am, because, you know, my own hometown in India has two nuclear power plants not far from where we live, not far from where we have an apartment. So it's not a very happy prospect, I want to say.
Wow, I think I'm properly terrified.
Yeah, I think you're not it's not unjustified at all. I think we all should be. We live in terror. It is a very scary moment in history. Really is.
So at the end of the day, if you had to blame one person or thing for the Bhopal gas tragedy, who or what would it be?
It never is one thing. I mean, if there's one thing we've learned, if there's one thing we've learned in studying disasters, in all these years, it is that a catastrophe in itself, contiguous to the large population, doesn't make for a disaster. It's patterns of vulnerability. And these patterns of vulnerability include, for example, lax regulation, poor investments, poor technologies, poor design decisions, poor communication, a political economic environment, an ideological environment that brushes away safety or denies climate change or does things like that. So it's a whole host of things. It's the way in which incentives flow within corporations to promote safety. I do apologize. I do. Yeah, so I'll go back a second there. It's a host of things, including, of course, how incentives flow within the way in which a corporation is organized.
Huh, that's interesting. How incentives flow. I mean, I take your point. Ravi, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us really understand this terrible tragedy that a lot of us didn't even know much about.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hi, Rebecca. How's it going?
I'm pretty scared. I'm having a pretty scary moment.
Yeah.
How about?
I mean, he really. That was a lot, but in a good way. It's stuff we should be talking about.
Totally, but I mean, how are we going to sleep at night? I mean, necessary, totally. But I loved, you know, hearing, well, I didn't love it, but I thought it was so interesting what he had to say and properly terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, when you asked him if we've learned from this, he just gave the most confident no.
That's right. The most confident no we've heard on this podcast ever.
It might have been. And so it really was chilling. But I definitely, he brought up a couple of points that I wrote down that I thought we could have put on the board. But all in all, I think we were in the right area.
Yeah, I would love to hear what you wrote down. What my major one that I'm now going to think about for a while is how incentives flow. And that, you know, to me said a lot about, I guess, capitalism and the way these companies work, and thinking about these companies and what they're doing in these other countries that are still developing and how they take advantage of them. And it's just like, it feels like a vicious cycle, which that he was referring to.
Well, yeah. And I think when he was talking about the lack of global environmental regulation, that was really interesting, because then you're leaving it up to these individual companies to sort of decide what safety measures are appropriate. And when they're just worried about the bottom line, they're not really looking out for the safety of the communities.
Yeah, are you suggesting that we should have put that on the board? Because I would agree with you.
Well, yeah, I think that could have gone on the board. So this is sort of what I wrote down. Starting from the top of the conversation, there was critical design decisions. And his point that even the facility in Virginia also had severe problems, and that Union Carbide had a bad history of this sort of thing.
Yeah, you're right. We should have put like a bad track record.
Yeah. He also mentioned low employee morale and a system of favoritism and cost cutting.
Yes. That was fascinating. I think that we were trying to touch on that with brain drain, but this is different. Company culture seemed to have been lacking. And that was actually, now that I think of it, an issue with the Chernobyl incident, where, you know, people didn't want to admit fault. I think in this particular tragedy, it was more that people didn't really trust management.
Right.
And each other. And from what Ravi was talking about, it looks like a lot of, you know, there was good reason not to, because some of the employees weren't even qualified to be doing that job.
Yeah. And it was interesting that he said they wanted to learn, but they weren't giving the opportunity to learn. And so that's why a lot of them left.
Yeah. So do you think I think that we ended up sending Union Carbide Company, but we also sent the other companies because we felt like they just kept passing the buck. But do you think that we should, that the blame really should have been put on the Union Carbide Company itself? Because that's what I'm thinking.
We ended up sending UCC and the India Limited portion of the company to jail.
Right.
And then we gave CEO Warren Anderson the big slap. So, I mean, we kind of, you know, we cast a wide net.
Which is the same reaction he had when I asked him.
Yes. That's true. And, you know, he used a phrase that I love that I think we should sort of integrate into our alarmist vocabulary. And that was patterns of vulnerabilities.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yes, because that really encompasses this thing that we keep trying to put our finger on, which is like taking advantage of people, taking advantage of situations, these corporations, bigger, you know, that also, that it really encompasses a lot of capitalism, but it's good. It's specific.
I mean, I think So I liked that phrase a lot, but there's something bigger going on here from sort of his environmental perspective and regulations and how he was talking about how we're regressing as far as these environmental regulations and who can we blame for that? Because I feel like that is really important and that definitely has to do with why this happened.
It feels like a lack of global leadership and a lack of interest in these environmental safety measures.
Yeah, and sort of a disregard for human life and science.
This is just terrible.
I know. But you know what? And I think, you know, we kind of rely on our big nations like the United States and China to sort of drive these environmental regulations. And when we're not doing that, it sort of starts to affect everywhere else in the world that we, you know, that are like stomping all around and ruining everything for everyone, which I do think, at least for the U.S., it comes back to capitalism.
Right. So do we want to give the big slap to lack of environmental global safety?
I'm down for that because we already sent the CEO to jail because he's part of, you know, the company. So I'm down with giving the big slap to lack of environmental regulations for sure.
Okay. I feel good about that. I think I'm going to call it. Okay. Lack of environmental global safety measures. You're getting the big slap. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people are going to have a red, they're going to see like a red mark on their face suddenly appear around the world right now.
That is true. And I think we don't really even need to offer the CEO, Warren Anderson, an ice pack because he also did deserve the slap. Let's be honest.
I don't feel bad about that first slap. You're right.
No.
I mean, here we go. Once again.
But again, we're starting to see, you know, history repeating itself. We've covered now several environmental disasters, and there are so many commonalities. And as our guest expert said, you know, he's just waiting for this to happen again. So thank you, Ravi, for that.
Alarm me. Don't let this happen. We need to be You need to be talking to everyone you know about this disaster. We need regulation.
Yes, seriously. Okay, so that actually, Rebecca, you're so good at segues because that leads us into asking the Alarmy to rate and review because that's how we spread the word about this podcast.
Yes, it's your job. It's your burden, but it's your delight, right?
Yes, it is your burden and your delight. So we've gotten a few reviews. We have to give a shout out to the people who are actually, you know, taking the time to do this. So this is a good one. It's such a fun podcast, 5 stars. Just found this podcast a few weeks ago and I'm already caught up. I love that they cover the more serious disasters, but also give a break with more lighthearted topics. If I could give this any more stars, I would.
Ooh. I mean, if those stars could count, I would take them.
I know.
You know, what you could do is ask a loved one to also rate and review. So,
or just take their phone and do it for them.
Amanda,
nothing wrong with that.
Tell them what to say. You know, it could be, you know, verbatim.
Yeah, just write like, I am typing this on a phone I stole, but this podcast is great, so it's worth it.
That's right. And we won't blame you. We couldn't possibly blame you for stealing the phone. You know?
No, you won't be sent to jail for that, no. for that crime.
No.
And then another thing that I'm excited about, and I think the Alarmy will be into, is we have a series of fun Halloween-themed episodes coming up.
Yeah. We've got a lot of scary, very scary episodes brewing in a witch's cauldron.
Yeah. Yeah. So from starting next week, for the next 3 weeks, we have fun Halloween episodes. And of course, we also have our live show that's coming up. So check the show notes for information on that.
Yeah. I don't think we've actually announced the live show yet. So,
well, we hopefully have by the time this comes out.
Oh, so yeah,
I'm assuming
you guys will already know what we're talking about.
Yes.
Should we tell them what we're going to do?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
To get everyone excited. So we are going to be covering Jaws, the movie Jaws. We're also going to be doing an episode on Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah. So this is the actual Dracula. And I the other night I watched the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula. I don't know. Have you seen that, Rebecca?
Not that one. Is that the one with a little Kirsten Dunst?
No, that's Interview with the Vampire.
Oh.
They're both really fun movies. You should watch them both. But the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula is with Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder. And it's really, you got to watch
it.
Wow.
It's kind of iconic.
And they do touch a little bit on Vlad the Impaler. So
that's exciting. Okay, so that's a good thing for our listeners to do to get excited about the episode, because you guys are not going to believe this crazy. He's a real person in history, and the stuff on him is just wild.
That's right. And then we have our live show coming up, which we're going to do. We've never done a serial killer, so we're putting our best foot forward by doing Ed Gein.
I'm so scared to start researching this one.
I know.
I mean, this guy inspired three of the scariest classic movies. There's Silence of the Lambs that he inspired, Psycho. And what is the third one, Amanda? It's
was it like the Chainsaw Massacre?
That's right.
Or
Chainsaw Massacre.
Is that what it was?
That's right. So
yeah, so we're going to get into that, and there'll be some visuals. So mark your calendars, October 23rd at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
It's going to be a fun, you know, we can't go trick-or-treating this year, so we might as well do this.
That's right.
Together.
It's going to get you in the Halloween mood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, another episode in the books, Amanda.
We did it. We really did.
One by one. We'll soon reach our 1 million episode goal.
I think we're almost there.
Yes. I think I did the math one time, and I would have to live hundreds, maybe thousands of years in order to get that done. But who said we can't do it, you know?
I mean, you know, maybe we could call in Vlad the Impaler to bring you eternal life.
Well, we're going to need him to do that to a few of us, because I can't do the show without you. So you're coming with.
Yeah, fact checker Chris, too.
Yeah, we'll see about that. We'll see. Tune in next week. We're going to be doing a lighter episode. We're covering the movie Jaws. Should be fun.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered.
Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.